Welcome to the Candid Conversations podcast. I'm Aviva, a third-year international development student. This is a space where we discuss current topics and issues in development with students and professors in the Institute. This semester, we're starting a series where we look at the basics of development. What is the past, present, and future of international development, and how does it interact with our modern society? On this episode, we're looking broad and asking that one big question: what is international development? So let's break that phrase down. The concept of development is the idea of change over time. International is something that involves more than a single country. When we put that phrase together, though, we get something a little more than just changing countries. In the past century, give or take, international development has expanded into a full-blown professional field. From researchers to writers to professors to students in development courses, they all work towards this idea of achieving international development. Now the question is, what do these professionals do? And what are they trying to change?
The United Nations Development Program's goals are to eradicate poverty and reduce inequality in developing nations. That means developing local capacity and institutional ability into long-term prosperity. Monetarily, the World Bank puts the extreme poverty line at those living on less than $2.15 per day. However, in reality, poverty is the result of the interaction of both monetary and non-monetary factors. In addition to economic measurements, indicators such as life expectancy, maternal mortality, and literacy rates are all more robust predictors of poverty. We'll get more into how development is measured on the next episode, but for now, let's look at some global challenges that international development addresses. Here is Peter Taylor, Director of Research at the Institute of Development Studies, on focuses in international development and present challenges with COVID-19.
COVID-19 especially has created enormous turbulence, throwing off track many of the economic and social improvements we've seen taking place. In addition to the lives lost, the global economic downturn, the ever greater threat to social cohesion and resilience, all often accompanied by a closing down of civic space, there's a rising tide of anxiety and uncertainty over what the future may bring. We're constantly reminded of systematic, institutionalized inequities, inequalities, and injustices experienced due to race, gender, ethnicity, religion, disability, age, and many other factors.
International development works to understand challenges ailing developing societies and finding ways to improve them. So what sectors need to be improved to change development? These processes could be social, political, economic, environmental, and many more. Hear from Enable, a development agency in Belgium, on why education must be at the heart of international development.
Education is a smart investment and a great socioeconomic equalizer. In sub-Saharan Africa, a girl's income rises by 20% for every additional year of school she completes. If all girls completed primary school, there would be 15% less child marriages and 65% less maternal deaths. Over the past 5 years, Enable's commitment to education allowed for over 1.5 million pupils and students to go to school and to learn in a safe and climate-friendly classroom. Over 200,000 teachers were trained to increase the quality of teaching and learning in an effort to fight the learning crisis. In an ever-changing and fast-developing world, lifelong learning is essential to both personal and professional development. Over the past 5 years, Enable reached out to over 20,000 people and organizations in 15 countries with continuous professional development activities. By the way, worldwide, 200 million children will still not be attending school in 2030. That's about 4 times all the school-going children in Europe. Imagine the potential if we jointly succeed in offering education, learning, skilling, employment promotion, and entrepreneurship support to all those talents. And imagine the risk if we fail to do so. That's why education, training, and employment should be at the heart of international development.
Ultimately, the work of international development would allow people and societies to live long, healthy, and productive lives. But where did all of this begin? International development has a bit of a shaky history, to say the least. After World War II, the Bretton Woods Agreement created a monetary management system among the United States, Canada, Western European countries, Australia, and Japan. This system would govern monetary relations among independent states, promoting an international monetary system. Alongside the new institutions, like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, Development emerged as a way to alleviate poverty and improve conditions in newly decolonized countries through economic growth. Along with this growing professionalization came a mirage of theories that guided professionals and changed the course of many of these states over the next half century. In the 1950s and 60s, a theory called modernization theory emerged as dominant in development theory. The traditional, or pre-modern, society would undergo industrialization to transform into a modern. This modern transformation occurred along with a political one that promoted anti-communist liberal values. Inspired by the work of sociologist Talcott Parsons' Guided Progress and Walt Rostow's Five Stages of Economic Growth, development would occur from a top-down perspective. Western or developed countries guide newly independent countries to so-called prosperity under the banner of anti-communist economic, social, and political ideals. Modernization theory was a one-size-fits-all idea of development that would start with economic growth, leading to changed values that supported liberal democracy, which to many theorists was the beacon of peace and development, or as Francis Fukuyama put it, the end of history. Modernization theory was the basis of United States foreign aid in the 1960s, with programs like JFK's Alliance for Progress and Peace Corps.
We meet in an hour of change and challenge, in a decade of hope and fear, in an age of both knowledge and...
But opposition grew by the end of the century, as modernization theory was quite general, and this one-size-fits-all approach was not an actionable solution for global development. Emerging from the opposition to modernization theory was an alternative explanation to underdevelopment and its solutions. This alternative explanation is known as dependency theory. Dependency theory counters modernization as a more internal approach to development. It states that underdevelopment is caused by trade inequality embedded in the international division of labor. This surrounds what's known as core-periphery relations. Essentially, developing countries, or periphery countries, will export low-value primary commodities to core countries, or developed countries, who then export high-value manufactured items. This core-periphery model, which was developed by John Friedman in the early 1960s, essentially shows how developed nations will subvert developing nations and maintain their economic, political, and cultural dominance. Dependency theory sees this relationship as the main cause of underdevelopment, and so their solution is strong state intervention, or industrialization by ISI, import substitution industrialization. Dependency theory essentially protects and gives priority to the growth of domestic industries. Tangible implementations combating dependency theory typically emerged in Latin America, also known as Latin American structuralism, with the rise of import substitution industrialization in many countries. This theory, however, did not fix internal structural inequality or political instability. Once again, after several years, dominant theories of development took a hard shift in the opposite direction. This time, neoliberal development emerged. Neoliberal development promoted free markets and minimal state intervention as the key to successful development. Neoliberalism was highly promoted by leaders in the West, such as Margaret Thatcher of the United Kingdom or Ronald Reagan from the United States. You may know a little phrase called Reagan's trickle-down economics, which applies to neoliberal development. To simplify greatly, if those at the top are making more money, eventually that trickles down to those at the bottom, and all around, everyone in society is earning more. However, as usual, this did not go to plan. Neoliberalism primarily emerged in the fervor of late 20th century anti-communism efforts. So free markets arose in tandem with political interventions that promoted anti-communist leadership in developing countries. One economic development program of neoliberalism are structural adjustment programs, or SAPs. Structural adjustment programs were conditions attached to loans from Bretton Woods institutions that essentially mandated free markets, deregulation, and the retreat of the state. These policies often resulted in what is known as thin development, or as David Harvey put it, accumulation by dispossession. Developing countries remained as sources of natural resources, while wealth remained with the elites, and due to the condition of the SAPs, many social services were defunded. The ideas of neoliberalism and free market economies still influence the ideas of the present. However, in terms of development, the theories and focuses have once again shifted, this time from the global back to the local. So now, fast forward to the 1980s, there is growing disappointment in Western-led, one-size-fits-all programs of development. inequality continues to widen under neoliberalism, and the growing impact of climate change leads to questions of sustainability and long-term potential. A shift in the development paradigm to human development essentially altered development to be human-centered, equitable, and bottom-up. One of the main features of this new paradigm was the notion that development is freedom. Pioneered by economist Amartya Sen, development would provide people the processes, opportunities, and capabilities to be free. Here it is in his words.
You see, I think there was a kind of contrast which has been present in the development literature for a very long time. There's one side which is saying, well, development is mainly getting the investment climate right and so forth. And the other is the development is mainly concerned with making human beings both more equipped, more free, more really free, not just freedom as permission, but freedom as a real ability to do things that they have reason to value, both individually as well as social beings, in terms of their contribution to the society. And that includes also participation, public discussion, public reasoning, sharing values, sharing concerns, sharing doubts, and sharing results and determination.
Sen cites the example of Kerala, an Indian state with a high human development index.
Now, I think in this approach, it's interesting that the question of Kerala came up. It was an interesting thing, with Kerala, for to some extent, reasons of history, originally being not a part of the British Empire, being a native empire, native kingdom, the Travancore and Cochin. They could carry some of a different policy than British India, and they went for education very early. But even though the average for Indian education was about, I think, 13% literacy when the British left, but the Kerala's figure was, well, in the 40s, higher, but not dramatically higher. But then with independence came very big burst in education first, but then on the basis of a nearly universally educated literate population, there was strong pressure for better public health care. And then the health care also became one of the showpieces of Kerala. Now, the reason why it's worth seeing today is decades have gone by, and Kerala, instead of being one of the poorest states in India, has become one of the richest states. This is, of course, exactly what was anticipated by those who were pushing for that line. It's not that you continue to deny economic growth, but understand that economic growth also depends on the quality of human beings that are being cultivated through deliberate public policy and social commitment. So now actually sometimes people who look at it say, well, Kerala can afford these things because it is a richer state. But that wasn't where the dialogue was earlier, when the dialogue was about Kerala not being able to afford it because it's a poor country. But I'm delighted that we've come to a stage now when Kerala, being one of the richer states, can more easily afford it. And this has happened to some extent in Tamil Nadu, in Himachal Pradesh, and to varying extent in different parts of India. And similarly, if you look at many other countries, Sri Lanka has been an old example, Costa Rica, many other countries across the world, Brazil, in a very big way, under the period of the presidency of Cardoso and later under Lula, converted what was a kind of unaimed growth into a participatory growth. And the Brazilian economy, with universal health care, close to universal literacy, has turned the page in a way the rest of the world, many parts of the rest of the world, have not.
Sen cites the example of Kerala, an Indian state with a high human development index, the result of investment in public policies. Human development provided an important intellectual basis to understanding inclusive and sustainable development. But when put in practice, it faced the reality of neoliberalism, the unequal economic distribution, the uninvolvement of the state, and the promotion by global financial institutions. Development theory and practice in the present is shifting to an idea of local, bottom-up development. This theory relies on the inputs, involvements, and resources of communities to develop. communal input and the consideration of factors beyond the economic, social, cultural, historical, institutional, lead to the potential of greater quality of life and human capacity. The local sustainable approach, informed by the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which we'll talk about in part two, is now accepted by larger development institutions. It's important to remember that this doesn't mean development is perfect. Power imbalances still exist between institutions and local communities, and between development workers and people, and so often cultural misunderstandings and ignorance get in the way of progress. Here is Taylor again on the directions and possibilities in development.
We see a sense of possibility of working together collaboratively and in partnership towards a world that's different to the one we have presently. By transforming knowledge and transforming lives, we want to build back better, to help transform systemically and sustainably the world we live in and the way we live in the world. And to do all this, we need to be truly adaptive, constantly and consistently learning from each other, bringing together the extraordinary value of different experiences from a wide range of contexts. We view knowledge as an essential ingredient of learning. At IDS, we aim to ensure the ways in which we produce and co-create knowledge, evidence, and data are legitimate, credible, and robust. Research helps us to generate knowledge that's relevant and that responds to needs. We believe in using the power of research and evidence and in working together to find solutions that address some of our most pressing problems and challenges.
And finally, some quick words from Sen to reiterate the value of intellectual involvement in development.
I think one of the really exciting engagement is how intellectual discussions could make a real difference to the practical world in which we live. And the contrast between practicality and theory, that's one of the, I think, terrible contrasts. I never lose my enthusiasm for arguing against that, because ultimately there's nothing as important as what we think in determining what we do, what we act, and what kind of lives we end up leading.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Candid Conversations. You can find us on Instagram at IDSSA Publications, on Instagram and Twitter at Catalyst McGill, and online at catalystmcgill.com. If you'd like to reach out to us, our email is catalyst.mcgill@gmail.com. Join us next week for part two, where we will be looking at how development is measured and what the Sustainable Development Goals are. If you are interested in coming on the show, you can reach us on Instagram or by email.